All right, today we have Zach Sloan, a musician, a producer, singer-songwriter, up from Colorado. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. I like your story, so maybe we should start there. This wasn't always your day job, right? So what I'd like
No.
to know is maybe you can tell us what your day job was. And how you
Sure.
made the decision and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do now.
Sure. So I started off in 2006. I started teaching fourth grade. I was a fourth grade teacher for 3 years and I loved it. But I was like kind of starry-eyed and I wanted to help more kids, and I was only helping like 30 kids a year. And so I went to law school and I became an attorney who represented abused, neglected kids. And I did that for 3 years. I practiced law for 5 years. And after 5 years of practicing law, I couldn't do it anymore. And I called my wife, Annette. I was like, man, I want to quit. And she was like, yeah, I know. And so I went to my boss. I gave him a month's notice and I started making music. And I had made one record prior to that, but it was not full time. And so, yeah, I was an attorney and I quit and I have never regretted it.
Yeah. So what was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back that said, this is what I want to do?
If I had really thought about it, I would have never done all the other stuff, right? Because when I was younger, the thing was, I went to music school first, and it was always like, you gotta have a backup plan, you gotta have a backup plan. And what happened to me is my backup plan became the plan. And so I went to music school, but I was like, I should really go. I'm good with kids, I should become a teacher. And I don't regret teaching. I loved teaching. But so I got my degree in early childhood education. And then I taught, but the whole time I was teaching, I would spend my entire summer making music. I had like a little, at the time, an 8-track and then a 12-track and then a 16-track recorder in my apartment, and I was making music, And then I went to law school, and I remember like my first semester at law school, right before finals, I was making music instead of studying. I was like, yeah, C's are fine. And so I think it was just an accumulation of years of me trying to suppress what I really wanted to do. And then after 5 years of practicing law, I just realized it was not for me, and I just walked away.
Fantastic. So today, what is your songwriting process like? You say you're up at 9 and trying to get to work. So do you say I have from 9 to 10, I'm going to sit and work on music and write, or is it sort of whatever you feel like?
That's actually a great question. I'm still refining that. So what I have is I have a special planner that I use, which is the Rockstar Life Planner that a friend of mine actually makes. But I love the planner because it doesn't have, I'll just give you like a random day. Like it doesn't have time slots in it. It just has big blocks. You may not be able to see it. I'll get it closer. But it just has big blocks of like days. And so what I do is I list the three or four important things I want to do that day. Like today, I know I need to reach out to at least five venues to book shows. I have some mixing I'm doing for a couple clients I work with, and I'm also working on my next record. And so I have those big ideas of what I want to do, and then I figure out when's the best time to do them. Like I know booking shows in the early morning is not useful because a lot of times you got to call the clubs and nobody's in until 2 o'clock. So I'll put that in the afternoon. So in the morning, usually the first thing I'll do is I'll either mix or record or track, because my ears are fresh, and get that going. Or if I have some emails that need to be attended to, I'll do that. And then from there, I sort of stack in the rest of the day. And what I do with songwriting is that if I decide I'm going to write a song, like say I have an idea, what I wind up doing is I say, okay, I have this idea for a song. I'll use an example of one I'm tracking now called Reckless and Ready. I had this idea for a song. I reached out to a co-writer. Don't always need a co-writer, so I'll do it myself a lot. And I say, I have this idea for a song, let's write the song. And then we schedule a time, or I schedule a time for myself. And then I don't stop until the song's done. Like that's my sort of my process, is I won't leave a song unfinished. I might edit later. Like I might go back and go, man, that lyric is kind of garbage. I better fix that. But if I leave a song unfinished, it will never get finished. So that's how I schedule it. And so I got to be careful, because if I can't, that means I'd never put anything after songwriting. So I usually songwrite like 2 or 3 in the afternoon at the earliest, because what if it takes 4 hours or 5 hours? You know, that's the most important thing I do. So I got to make sure I block out that time.
I actually like that approach, because I'll agree with you. I'll write something and walk away from it. And there's a couple of verses, maybe a chorus, and it'll never, ever see the light of day again.
Yeah. And I also think it helps you really, like, there have been times where I've been 2 hours into a song and I'm fighting with it and fighting with it. So I'll just do a quick demo and I'll listen to it. I'm like, yeah, it's because it's a terrible song. That's why I can't finish it. It doesn't need to be finished because it's bad. And that's cool too. Like, you got to get through that.
So getting through that, does that mean, I know, like, if you look at in the industry, right, these guys are writing 300 songs a year, right, and pitching maybe, I don't know, 10, 20 of those, or actually 10 or 20 of those are getting cut. So do you follow the same process? Do you just keep writing and writing and writing? And
yeah, you know, what was funny, for my record I'm working on now, I had this idea that I was going to write 30 songs and then pick like the best 10 and make an album. And so I set aside like a couple of months just to write songs, and that's all I focused on. And so I got to like 30 or 32 or 33 or whatever. And then I started like tracking and demoing. And then I just sort of kept getting song ideas. It was like, at first I was like, well, I'm not writing right now. I was like, that's stupid, man. If you have an idea, write the song. So I wound up writing, I think I'm at, of my list here, I'm at 45 songs now that I've written for this record. And I know that a lot of them aren't very good. And that's okay. But kind of more to your question, like the people who are writing 300 songs a year, I totally get that. I don't necessarily think I have the time for that. But if you're, say, pitching songs for, you know, other artists, or you have a publishing company or something, it makes total sense to do that, because it's kind of a numbers game at some point, is that you have to have enough material out there so that other people will do it. And a buddy of mine, just he's had 2 artists cut albums of just his material, but he's been doing it 20 years, you know, like he had to have that material out there, and he goes through a lot of bad songs to get to the good ones, I'm sure.
Totally. That totally makes sense. My next question is, what are your goals for songwriting? I'm beginning to wonder if any of your past experience, I mean, you said you really wanted to work with children and that really mattered to you. Does that somehow come into your songwriting?
Yeah, because, so it's funny now for me, is like my kids who I used to teach all are out of high school, which makes me feel old. But I'm still, like, thanks to Facebook, like, you know, Facebook has its problems, but I appreciate it for the fact that I'm in touch with a lot of my students. And if I start getting too pessimistic, I do have that thing in the back of my head saying, you know, those kids that I really cared about who are now adults might hear this. And so I want to put that kind of negativity out there? And so like, there have been times, you know, in the past year, like just being an election year, where I was just frustrated all the time. At one point I was like, man, I have a lot of bitter songs. I better turn that ship around. And just because I'm unhappy with something doesn't mean I have to like express despair. I can put it in more of a social change or a movement context. And so those kids are always like in the back of my head. And it's not just the kids I taught, right? I used to represent abused and neglected children, and, you know, their lives were tough enough without me putting out more negative stuff in the world. You know, those kids, I was funny, because I would always just like, when I would be with them, we would listen to a whole lot of banging hip hop. And it was funny because, like, in hindsight, I go, well, yeah, they want to listen to a lot of songs about like people enjoying life and having fun and things like that. They were into, even some of like my kids from the roughest situations were into not only like party hip hop, but like Miley Cyrus and stuff, because, man, their life was tough enough. They didn't need anybody else bringing them down. So they listened to music that was fun. And so I try to do that. Even if I'm writing like a sadder song, I will try and put some sort of positive spin on it somehow.
Fantastic. So when you sit down and you have a song, is there a goal? I mean, I know you said that the goal is just to get the song out, be done with it. But now that you have this album, do you have a specific goal of this, like, these are the people I want to reach, or is it just, I just want to get my music out there?
Yeah, you know, now that it's a business, like when I did my first record, when I did New Orleans, New Mexico, I didn't intend to put that out. Like, I just recorded it and I was like into the mixing phase and I was like, oh, this is not bad. And I started playing it for people and they liked it. And so I was like, okay, I'll release it. But I had a job. And now, like, now that it's a source of income, I do have specific people I want to reach. And what I do is I look really hard at like my Spotify analytics. I look at who's purchased my album and figure out what my demographic is. And then I try and reach those people. So I've run some Facebook ads, only a few, where I'm targeting, you know, women in their late 30s and early 40s, men in their, I think it's 24 to 32, and about a 50-50 split of that. Teenagers, almost not at all, because they don't listen to me that much. Plus, they don't have that much money to buy music with anyway. And so I have those specific people that I'm trying to reach. But I'm also trying to reach a broader audience, which is nice with the internet because I can kind of do that. You know, I'm pretty active on Twitter. So I'm always looking for people who might be into my stuff. And I'm chatting them up on Twitter or sometimes, you know, on Instagram a little bit. So it's like I have a specific audience I'm trying to reach and then a broader audience that I'm trying to reach. And at the same time, like to the second half of what you were asking, yeah, sometimes I just want to put music out. And I just put it out there. So I release a single a month, too, just to keep myself from being stagnant. Because it's not like I don't have the material. I've got plenty of songs written. So I'm cranking out a tune a month. I'm even contemplating going up to two a month just to get it out. And just so that it's, if you go to my Spotify profile, if you stumble upon me, you can see that I'm doing something. I'm not one of those, you know, pages that gets put up and then is neglected.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a little bit of both, really.
Cool. Okay, so you're based out of Colorado. How is the music scene out there, right? I mean, I don't know if it's definitely a music town or where you're at. How do you collaborate with people? Do you just, you already have a set people that you go to, or do you reach out to somebody else? Or
yeah, so the first part of that, like the Colorado music scene is not as good as I would like it to be. Not to say there's not good players. There's a wealth of talent out here. But before I ever played a show in Colorado, I toured toured is probably a strong word. I had a band that was based in Lubbock, Texas, and in the weekends we would go play Austin, Houston, Dallas, all those places. And the Texas music scene is amazing because it is the most supportive music scene I've ever been in. And I've, you know, and I suspect California, I don't know what California is like. I hear like in the Bay Area, it's a similar kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That is it not? Okay.
It's definitely becoming better. I mean, I think there was these high points, right? Like you look at the 60s and the 70s, a lot of bands, fantastic bands and musicians came out of here. Even in the 2000s, sort of, I just talked to someone who's a, sort of like you, a musician and a producer. And there was a scene in the 2000s and it sort of just died when streaming and stuff came out. I'm based out of San Jose and it's sort of coming back up. I did a gig at a coffee shop and it blew my mind. We were the only band that showed up with like acoustic guitars. Everybody had like electric and it was a heavy metal scene in a coffee shop.
Really?
Yeah.
Like intentionally, like the coffee shop booked, they were like booking metal bands.
It was they were trying to do a band night, so it was the weirdest setup I've seen. There's two stages, and you know, one band was set up while the other band was playing, and people drinking coffee, turning left, turning right, and watching band after band. We were the only mellow band. But wow. It's sort of like it's not as strong as like you were saying, Austin or even New York. Mm-hmm. LA, of course, the scene is fantastic, but up here in the Bay, it's very mellow.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And Colorado has kind of a similar thing where But I think there's two parts to Colorado. One is I don't think the clubs are necessarily as open to having live music because the people, like, nobody really comes to Denver for music. Like, people come to Denver for skiing and for weed. And, like, whereas if you go to Austin or Nashville or LA or New York, there's this, you're gonna go see a band. It's just what you're gonna go to the Whiskey a Go-Go. You're gonna go to places like that. And so clubs don't necessarily invest in it as much. But there are a few, and when I find those clubs, I get to know the owners really well, and I go and I support them, and then they support me, and that's really good. So that's sort of the Colorado scene. But the nice thing about the Colorado scene is that the musicians, by and large, are pretty cool. Because you'd ask, how do I collaborate with people? And I go to a lot of open mics. Even though open mics don't pay and they're not really great exposure, they're a good place for me to work on new material. And it's a good place to just meet a bunch of musicians. And, I don't know what it's like where you're at, but, here, it's the singer-songwriters who go to open mics, And those are the people I want to know, And so I go to a lot of open mics. I try to go to one a week at least, meet new musicians, pass out business cards. And if I hear somebody who writes good songs, I say we should write a song. I try to book it as quickly as possible. Because if I hate that thing where you're like, hey, we should work together, we should jam, and then it never happens. It's like, hey, we should write a song together. What are you doing on Friday? Or whatever. And get that booked. And then the second way I reach out for collaborations, and I just did this, I released a single on New Year's Eve called The Date Was Bad, But the Night Was Good. That's a duet with country singer Allie Rose. And I had this idea for the song, and I wanted it to be a duet. And so I just got in Reverb Nation and I looked at singers in my area and I just started reaching out to people. Like, hey, I like what you do. I have this idea for a song, let's write it. And Allie got back to me and was excited. And so we got together, we wrote it in an afternoon, we tracked it and released it. But Reverb Nation is like, it's almost like the I don't know, the Tinder of musicians. Like you get together and you can write a song, and then she
I
moved
did
to
not
LA like right afterwards,
I totally did not know that. I've not really actually checked that Reverb Nation, so I'm gonna have to put on my list to look at.
Reverb Nation's an interesting beast because there's a lot of people on it who, like, you can tell that there are people who spend money to get like followers. Because they'll have like 10,000 followers and then like no engagement, And then some of the more most successful songwriters I know, like they've put a page up and they've ignored it. And it's like, but they have more streams than anybody else. They have like seven followers. It's hilarious. So I always like, I look at those numbers as like vanity metrics. I don't really pay attention to that. I go through and I like, who looks like they're playing shows? Because then they're active. And do I like what they do? It's like a good way to find talent. It's not as impressive, I think, as some people make it out to be.
So going back to your work, do you have any established routines, practices that you do before you start or after you finish?
Like for writing? So this is actually something I've just started doing whenever I, well, just like in the past 6 months. Whenever I have an idea, I always write. I used to keep it in my phone. I had an app, and I used Evernote or whatever, and I would keep ideas in my phone. And then I read about how Kirk Hammett lost his phone making the new Metallica record, and lost like 12,000 riffs or something crazy. And so now I put it all in like my planner. I just write down ideas. And so what I do is whenever I decide I'm going to write, if I haven't written in a while, I will just put a day in my calendar, like you're going to write. Excuse me. And then I go through my ideas. And I go, which one is cool? Like, which one is resonating with me in that moment? And I'll start writing on that. And, if the song turns out good, my post routine is that I do a quick demo of it as quickly as possible. That was redundant. I very quickly do a demo of it. So that A, I don't forget it, because sometimes I'm a master at writing a song and forgetting how it goes. But B, what I've learned is like if I can get a demo out of just me and an acoustic guitar or me and a piano, I know pretty quickly if the song's good or bad, because I can listen to it the next day in my car or while I'm walking the dog and go, oh, that's good or that's bad. And that helps a lot rather than what I used to do of writing a bunch of songs and then trying to pick the ones from just writing them that I, because I just picked my favorites that weren't necessarily the best, you know? I'm sure as a songwriter, you've run into that too. It's like your personal favorites, other people may not really dig as much, you know, because they don't have that connection that the writer has.
Yeah. Well, if that's an interesting topic, because which kind of brings me to my next question is, who do you trust after you're done writing to critique your work?
The masses. So that's, I was talking to my wife about this last night. I pull up my Spotify analytics and I'm looking at it and I go, wow, I have, because you know, if once you verify your account, which as an artist is super easy to do, and if anybody wants to reach out to me about how to do that, I'm happy to help. Once you verify your account on Spotify, you can look to see like what songs are getting played the most regularly. And so I manufacture my set list for live shows because I was like, I have one song on my record, Nowhere New Mexico, that has about half as many plays as the rest of the record. Huh. That's a song people probably aren't enjoying. Cool. That's good to know. But that's in the post-production. You know, that's post that record's out. If I'm trying to figure out what material to release, what I will do is I sort of start compiling. I stole this from Bruce Springsteen, by the way. This is not an original idea. I will write a bunch of material and then I'll look at what tells, like, what songs fit together in sort of a story. And because not every song is going to be a single or a hit or anything like that, but what songs sort of flow together naturally. And then from there, I say, what are the elements that a good record, in my opinion, needs to have? You need to have, you know, for me, at least one or two cool rock and roll songs. You need to have some mellow stuff and everything in between. So then I get those ideas all like laid out, and this is usually like on three or four pieces of paper, right? Like I've got all this stuff, and then I will go to my wife because she has to deal with me the most, and my bandmates sometimes, and I will just say, you know, here's what I'm thinking. What do you think of these songs? What do you think of these songs? And I'll bounce it off of them. My guitar player in my band is particularly blunt, and so if something's bad, he'll just be like, I don't like that, and that stings, but it's cool. It's good information to have. So I trust them. I don't trust my mom because she says everything I do is great. But I do have a few musicians who I will ship stuff to. And then I use Twitter too. Like if I see people on Twitter who are into music that is in my area, I will reach out to them and say, hey, I'm thinking about releasing the single. Can I send you a demo and you can tell me if it sucks? And Twitter people and Twitter are very, they are very honest. They'll tell you.
Yeah, that's fantastic because I just spoke to another musician, and you know she went her whole life thinking that she wasn't good enough because you know her parents didn't like the music she was into, so it was kind of like, oh no, you're not good, right? So don't do it. But she sang in public just this one time, and somebody said, oh my God, you're fantastic. And that's all it took, right? That's all it took for her to say, this is it, I'm going into music. So that's why I always wonder, like, before you release material, is there this, you know, here are my five people I go to, give them a copy, they're brutally honest, here's my demo. But you're saying you actually go to the masses and you may even pick random people off of Twitter and see what they like.
And I think the most important thing is I trust my own ear. Like,
Yeah.
you know, if I feel strongly about it, then I know I will produce it in such a way that it will help the song. And also another good way I think for artists to figure out what material to release is to just gig with it a little bit. Like even if it's an open mic, you know, go play at an open mic and see how people respond. Because I released a single a couple months ago called Porcelain that I wrote. I really liked, but it was sort of outside my stylistic wheelhouse. And I played it at a show, and I saw a woman in the crowd like tearing up and like having like an emotional reaction to it. And I thought, oh, maybe I should release that song because people they're like physically responding in a good way. And I was like, okay. And I don't know if I would have released that song, and now it's my most popular song on my Spotify streams. You know, so Christina Stoner, if you see this, thank you. You're dope.
That's cool. Almost sort of like what stand-up comedians do, right? Test your material go back. All right, so talking about that, what are you struggling with today? What would you like to change?
Oh, you know, running a business is not easy. As much as I would like to be like, oh, it's so great to be an indie musician, you know, I'm struggling to pay the mortgage. So it's a matter of figuring out ways to get music out and do things that I enjoy and find a way to, you know, make money from that and be self-sustaining. So for me, you know, that's probably the biggest thing that I struggle with. And then every now and then I always struggle with like the, am I not good enough? Is maybe my music's just bad? You know, what if I'm just like that one dude who we've all met who thinks they're the second coming of Bob Dylan and then they're just terrible? You know, so those are probably my two, is the financial piece. And then like that constant, the inner critic of like, you're not good enough, you know? And I did a video with my friend Ann Luna where she talked about her inner critic about, you know, you're writing a song and you think it's crap, you know, or you do a show and people respond well and you're just like, oh yeah, but I missed that one thing and it was a bad show. Like those are the things that I think I struggle with quite a bit. I don't think it's that unique amongst the musical community. I think we all sort of feel that in one way or another.
How do you overcome that internal struggle of good enough?
Oh, you know, this sounds bad and I don't mean it to be bad, but like get out there in your music scene.
Yeah.
And go find the people who are doing better than you and take a hard look and say, are they better than me? Or maybe have they just progressed their career in a way that I just haven't got to yet? Because there are some acts out there who in the Denver scene who are like air quotes doing better than me. But they come to me and ask for help with songwriting or production or how to put together a live show. It's like, oh, maybe they've just been doing it longer than me. Maybe they've, you know, they've done X, Y, and Z and I haven't done it yet. And so that really helps. It's not that they're bad or I'm better or they're worse. It's just that like we're sort of equal, but for where they're at in their career. And so that helps me because it's like, okay, I don't suck because these people I respect and admire are asking for my opinion. So I must not be terrible.
Now I totally get what you're saying. I went to a show once and band that I love, and there was an opening act, and you know, this guy messed up timing and stuff, but he just kept going. And I'm like, it's like you said, it sounds terrible, but for a moment I was like, hey, he's actually making it, and he kind of sort of messed up.
Yeah, like that's the thing, like when you play live, especially in the live context, man, you don't have to be perfect, you have to be entertaining. Like that's what people care about. My biggest flaw as a live musician is I forget lyrics all the time, even my own songs. But I've never once had somebody in a live setting be like, man, I can't believe you forgot the blah, blah, blah words. Like, yeah, I just mumbled through it. Half the time, bar sound is so bad they can't tell anyway. So, right. You know, it's fun. And I don't mean that in a negative way of like go looking for people who aren't good. Like we should all support each other, but also like go see that. You don't have to be Prince. Like, there are those people who are up here, but there's a whole lot of room for the rest of us to do well together.
I think it's okay to be a lot less critical about ourselves.
Yeah. Like, you don't have to be. And I also feel that way. And this is just like me and as a producer, is that, you know, it drives me nuts. And this, I don't work with some people because of this. Like, they get overly perfectionist. It's like, oh, I want it to sound like, I want it to be perfect. And then we want to like line everything up exactly on the beat. And I'm like, you know, that's not really like, that's cool. If that's what you're into, that's cool. You should just do that with somebody else. Cause like that does not resonate with me at all. Like it's sometimes the imperfections and the mistakes that are cool. Yeah. And I dig it. And if you don't, we're probably not going to be a good fit. So you should find somebody else to work with.
But do you think that's part of what's happening today, right? And I discussed this in an earlier interview I had. I keep forgetting the title of that book, but David Byrne's book. He talks about recording and how opera singers back in the days, they were asked to do vibrato because the recording technology really sucked. So it was a lot easier for them to do vibrato and then leave the real pitch correction to the listener, right? Apparently our brains can listen to vibrato and pick the right pitch.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, but it was done so often that everybody after that figured out, okay, if I am an opera singer, I need to have a very good vibrato.
Interesting.
Right?
So like recording limitations built the technique.
Yeah, and then now that's what everybody does. So, you know, is that what's happening today, right? You have autotune and perfect pitch and everything is absolutely perfect on the record, right? And everything's recorded at high intensity. Is that what people assume, children will assume this is what it is to be a singer? I have to hit these marks.
Yeah. Well, I think another thing with that too is like, funny that you bring up the recording technology, because when I work with like, say, people who are based in like the hip hop world or electronic world, you know, the equipment will freak out sometimes if you don't have something snapped to the grid perfectly.
Yeah.
And so then it's like, because of that, and it makes sense in that context, but then they're like, what if, so one example is I was recording guitars for somebody doing like an electronic kind of thing. And they're like, oh, but the guitars have got to be snapped to the grid. I'm like, no, they actually don't. Like, it's not going to sound weird. It's going to sound human. Like, it's cool. And like, we finally, I just let them do whatever they wanted to do with editing. Cause I was like, I'm not winning this fight. It's their record. So whatever. But like, what becomes commonplace for one thing sort of gets pushed across everything else. Like, I'm terrified for the day that people start putting auto tune on guitars. Like, it's going to happen. It just hurts me inside.
I believe so. I mean, if the way technology is going in AI, I'm pretty sure you could pitch correct a bad bend or anything, right?
Totally. Just to see what would happen, I've messed around with it. And I'll admit, it sounds interesting. I don't like it. But I can see somebody who's really creative doing something cool with it.
Yeah.
Because my bending technique's not, it's funny, that's the exact reason I thought of it, is it was like I had a bend that was off. I was like, I just fixed that. And I was like, no, I just re-recorded.
That's funny. So how did you get into production? Because that's part of your business also, right?
Out of necessity. That's not entirely true. Now it's out of necessity. Initially, so when I went to music school, when I first got out of high school, I went to this 2-year college in Levelland, Texas called South Plains College, which I highly recommend. I wish I had finished. I didn't, but I took an audio engineering class where it was just like the basics of like here are the different types of microphone. Here's how you set it up to get sound. And, you know, the whole point of that course was getting sound to tape and miking up instruments properly. That was it. And I took that course, and at the time I was like, I'm going to be the band. I'm always just going to hire studio pro engineers for that stuff. I'm never going to do it. And so then I became a teacher. I had written all these songs, and I'd always had a cassette 4-track recorder that I demo songs on. And then I got an 8-track because I wanted to do a little bit more with that, you know, with my demos. And then I got a 12 and then a 16. And then I started like doing my own records, and I got to the point where, you know, when I was releasing Nowhere New Mexico, it was cost prohibitive. Even though I had a job at the time, I couldn't afford to go and do a studio. And so I started making that record, and I found, what's the name of it? Ohm Studio. Because I had like the, what's it, Steam, where you can download like software and video games and stuff. I just typed in free DAW or free DAW, and this free DAW came up, and so I learned how to use it. And then I went, oh, this is not as hard as I remember. Because I had learned on tape where everything was very complicated. You were like, you know, and I never had to do it, thank God. But like, you would take a razor blade and cut the tape and tape it back together. And I assume, but then I was like, oh, this digital stuff's not too bad, yo. Like, I should. And so from there, then I upgraded from Ohm, and I bought a nicer DAW, and I use Reaper now. And I was doing it initially with just the plan to do my own records. And then I had a couple people who, you know, listened to my music and they liked it. And they're like, hey, can you do, want to do an album for me? I'm like, sure. You know, so I did Dan Manley's album, Write the Book. We did an EP in a couple of months, just like right here in this space that you see. You know, we set up his keyboard and, you know, he did his vocals here. We cut everything right here. And it just became this thing where, like, the more I did it, the better I got at it. And then after I did Dan's record, I had another person reach out to me, and then another person, and then I did Jeremy Fackman's record, which was a really cool album to do. And it just sort of snowballed. But really, it was just because I couldn't afford a studio. And I don't know, Prasoon, are you familiar with the recordingrevolution.com?
No.
It's probably the website I credit the most with, like, A, giving me the confidence, and B, giving me the skill set. It's mostly free. There's a little bit of paid stuff, but it's mostly free. It's just this dude who makes a really good, convincing argument that, because he's a professional engineer and a mixing engineer. And he's like, you know, the cheapest stuff you can buy in 2017 or 2018 now is like the top of the line stuff from 1997. And they made really good records in 1997.
Yeah.
And as long as I've been making music, I always say to myself, like, whenever I'm like, I need to buy more gear, I need this compressor, or I need blah, I'm like, dude, you have more than the Beatles ever had. Shut up, write better songs.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is like, you get, none of it matters if you don't have a good song. So he does, true, a good job.
I can't blame these tools.
like you can have a Ferrari, but if you don't know how to drive, it doesn't really matter, you know. So that's sort of the long answer. It was necessity, and then like technology allows us to do it, you know. There's not a barrier to entry to make an album anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely not elite anymore. You don't really need a studio, right?
No.
I love it. What have you learned so far that if you had another go at it, you'd be like, okay, I'm not going to repeat this again?
Oh, like a mistake that I really... You know what? When I started doing Nowhere New Mexico, I kick myself for this all the time. What I did is I took my initial batch of songs that I recorded in Ohm Studio. And I had those, and I put those on the record. But then in the middle of that, I swapped over and changed DAWs. And so that first batch of songs sort of got lost in the ether. Like, I bet if I spent enough time, I might be able to track them down. But every now and then I need like instrumental parts from some of those songs, and I just can't get to them. I should have re-recorded all of that in my new DAW, which had a slightly better sound, because it wasn't... It's not because it was free that it was better, but like I understood how to use it better, and, you know, or the paid one. I should have re-recorded everything and make sure that everything was consistent, because like there is a quality drop off, and I don't have the capacity to go back. And like if somebody asked for an instrumental cue from my song Whiskey Kiss, I would just have to re-record it now instead of just going in and stripping the vocals. So that's a big one for me. And the other one is I spent so many years not finishing songs. Like I can't imagine how many songs that I left unfinished, where I should have just done what I do now and just bang it out.
Yeah, that's a big one. All right, maybe I'll this is our last question. What kind of advice would you have for someone who's starting out today as a songwriter?
Hyper-creation. I think that the modern music industry is skewed towards the hyper creators. And what I mean is like, I think the days of an album, like going 2 or 3 years between albums are gone. The audience will generally forget about you. And so if you're a new songwriter, get yourself a YouTube channel, like just make one and just release all the music you can. Like write, who cares if it sucks? Like you put it on YouTube, somebody's going to say something nasty anyway, so who cares? Like just start creating and get it out there, and you know, and people will let you know what resonates with them. And so I would say if you're a new songwriter, just do it as much as you can. Get your music in front of people as much as you can. That doesn't mean work necessarily for free a lot. Like you're going to play some free gigs, but you know, don't let yourself be taking advantage of at the expense of getting music out there. But get it out there as much as possible, because I think that's the direction the industry is going to go, or is already going. Just do it. It's like anything though. Pursue, like, you just got to do it. I didn't get good engineering and production until I did it, you know, and I get better because I do it more. Like, just write a lot of songs, man. There, that's the advice. Write a lot of songs. Just do it. It's cool.
Keep creating. I love it. Okay, maybe I lied. I got one more question. What would you want to ask another songwriter?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. You know, whenever I listen to like John Cougar Mellencamp albums, or John Mellencamp, he probably hates the Cougar thing now. John Mellencamp, or like Springsteen, or Joni Mitchell, or any of those songwriters, like or Dylan, right? Those classic songwriters who write like story songs, right? Like I was listening to The Ghost of Tom Joad by Springsteen the other day, and I was like, how do you write a song that is this detached from who you are? Right, because when Springsteen wrote that, he was a mega star. But then you like listen to that record, and it's like he's got songs about people who are coming to California to do as migrant workers, and how like the man is oppressing them, and it's like how do you do, how? And Dylan did that too. He was, a rich famous dude. And he was still writing like some legitimate protest music, like. I always find myself sort of in my own world. How do you get yourself out of your own world and writing about others in a meaningful way that is not contrived? That always blows my mind that people can do that and do it well. So I would want to know how they do that.
Okay, cool. Thanks for joining me today and telling me about your process and the things you do. And I hope to hear more of your music.
Hey, I've been enjoying some of your stuff too, man. And thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun. It's, I'm sure you, I mean, you're doing it, it's like, it's fun to chat with songwriters about like songwriting. It's cool.
This is the best thing I've been doing lately.
Yeah, it's a good time. And I've been enjoying like whenever I see your stuff up on Instagram and things like that, I really enjoy it. So
Oh, thanks so much, man.
keep cranking away, man. I'll see you soon.
See ya.
All right, take care.